This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hey, sports fans, it's Mason Crosby.
And Reese Crosby.
If you enjoy football, football,
be sure to check out Kicking It with the Crosbys. New episodes drop every Tuesday and Thursday.
Subscribe on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Gotta go. Gillespie for three. Goal or no, Holloman looks the clock. Half court for the win.
Chris is trying to get me sick this morning. Hard to get over that one last night. An unbelievable building last night, and also an incredible shot. 58-55 Michigan State. We're talking Terps right now. We'll get to some football, I promise. But joining us right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline, is Rafael Davis. Rafael does a phenomenal job and has now for several years on the Big Ten Network. One of my favorite college basketball analysts anywhere. And I'm pretty sure he was in studio last night with former Illinois coach Bruce Weber and Dave Revson. What did you guys do when that thing went in? I was looking forward to overtime.
Oh no, it was a big scream. It was a big yell. Everybody was shocked. Everybody was excited. Trey Holloman is one of my favorite guys that I've covered here in the Big Ten the last 4 years, and my excitement for Trey kind of blurted out. I think they put a video of the studio reaction on.
I'm looking at it right now. I didn't see it before we started. I'm looking at it right now. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was a fun night. It was a great game, fun night, defensive battle. But, yeah, when Trey hit that shot, I felt like my nephew made a game winner, and it was pretty cool.
So I love your analysis of the Big Ten and college basketball in general. And I've heard, you know, a lot of what you've thought about these two teams, you know, over the last few weeks. But tell me what you think of both teams coming out of last night's game.
Oh, my opinion doesn't change. I mean, because you look at Maryland – and yeah, they lose that game, but you look at it, Maryland goes 4 for 20 from 3. Maryland gets out-rebounded by 12. They get beaten the paint by 12. I mean, they just got outplayed all the way around. But at the end of the day, they had a chance to take that game in overtime with a chance to win it. So it just shows you how talented Maryland is. I mean, Julian Reese and Derrick Queen, they go 4 for 18 from the field, 14 points, and you still have a chance to win the game. I mean, you get 0 bench points, and you're still right there with a top 10 team in the country. So I think it just shows Maryland how good they are. It shows them that they can win, where they can be in close games. They can be in games where they make a lot of shots and it's pretty. So I was impressed with their fight. But then also, I mean, and then Riley Rice, man. Riley Rice is a dude. Like, Riley yeah. Rice is extremely talented. So then for Michigan State, it just keeps solidifying what they already believe, that they're a really good team. Like, I talked to Trey Holloman probably twice a week, and they feel like they're a Final Four team over there in East Lansing. So when you look at that win last night, it kind of puts some validity to that opinion, to that thought. But you go out and they lost that game to Indiana at home. But since then, it's been Illinois, it's been Purdue, it's been Michigan, now Maryland. So Michigan State is clearly one of the better teams in the country. And what I take from it, too, for Michigan State is all of these analytics people. I mean, I get numbers are numbers, but the game is the game at the end of the day. And Tom Izzo has shown everybody in the country you can still win playing old-school, tough, physical, hard-nosed basketball. And I enjoy that the most.
You know, You played in the Big Ten at Purdue for Matt Painter. You're a Big Ten guy, and we're now at Maryland Big Ten people. It's the 11th season now that we've been in the Big Ten. I'm amazed every year at the type of teams that Izzo has. They are tough, physical, highly competitive. They rebound. For whatever reason, teams still don't always get back on defense even after a made bucket. Like, how does he essentially produce the same style of team year in and year out?
Well, yeah, I'll say, I mean, just Kevin, I'll say the last couple of years he hasn't. I'll say
yeah, that's
look
true.
At the A.J. Hogard tenure, you look at the Malik Hall tenure, and you look at where Michigan State was, they didn't have that. They were soft. I mean, they were, and I say this nationally, they were soft the last few years. That team didn't buy into what Coach Izzo wanted to do. But you look at this team, this year's squad, all these guys wanted to be Spartans in high school. All of these guys knew what the deal was in high school. All of these guys understood the assignment. And then all of these guys, they have so much respect and admiration for the guys that came before them. And obviously you look at Jace Richardson, it was his father. But you look at Jeremy Fears and Mateen Cleaves, or you look at Jayden Akins and the way he talks about Gary Harris, and Gary Harris is the reason he wanted to be a Spartan. So those guys, they understood what they signed up for. And I was a part of a team at Purdue, and Michigan State didn't get to this point, but when the leaders are bad, when the coach and the point guard don't necessarily have a great rapport, and things are going sour on the court, it affects the locker room. And those guys, when you think of Trey Holloman, or you think of Jackson Kohler and even Xavier Booker and Colin Carr, it wasn't fun for those guys last season. Like, that wasn't fun to sit in, to be in a negative environment at Michigan State. Although they made the tournament, it wasn't a season where they met their standards. So I think Michigan, Tom Izzo has gotten buy-in from those dudes. He recruits to that. I mean, you got to go get a Jeremy Fears and a Trey Holloman, some dogs, some junkyard dogs that want to get up and down the floor. So he takes his time in recruiting. He expresses the value in it. He shows them the value in it. And then the former guys. I love how – one of the things I love most about Coach Izzo is how connected he is to his alums. And when you have former guys coming back and telling you how important it is, especially guys from a national championship team, I mean, that does something for you. So I've just been really impressed at those guys. And in today's era, society is soft now. Kids are soft. So to be able to get kids to buy into this toughness mentality – it's been cool to see Izzo doing today's game.
They were outstanding last night on defense. Their offensive rebounding, incredible. So I had Kevin Willard on the show earlier this week, and I asked him, I didn't expect to get an answer, but I was curious if he knew the kind of team that may not be the best matchup for his team. Do you think we saw it last night, the team that really can guard, especially on the perimeter and in the and on the post? Their pick-and-roll defense was incredible last night. Did we see the type of team that Maryland doesn't want to see in March?
No, I will say that. I mean, again, Maryland's not going to shoot 4-for-20 most nights from three. So, I mean, and they had a chance to win that game. And you look at it, Maryland gave Michigan State the same problems. I mean, it wasn't like Michigan State were lights out on the offensive end. I mean, they struggled too. So that's why I don't think so. I think Maryland's a team that they can compete with anybody in the country. Look across the country, Auburn presents those same problems. I mean, Duke presents those same problems. Good teams, really good teams. They can force you to play in the half court. They're big inside. They're physical. They're long. They're athletic. So Michigan State just falls right into that vein, and so does Maryland. So I would say Maryland's a team that others don't want to face for those same reasons, because Maryland, they can get you on the glass. Maryland can get you in transition. Maryland can get you with their defense. So I just think it was two heavyweights going head-to-head, and you saw at the end of that game, Maryland fought back. I mean, those last 2 minutes, Maryland should have lost that game by 12. But then they fought back, and they got themselves back in a position to win the game just because of how talented they are. So I don't think that game changes any opinions for me. A buzzer beater doesn't really shake up things. But I think for Maryland, you saw last night, everyone's been saying, well, what happens with Maryland's depth? What happens? Well, Selt Miguel got in foul trouble, only played 2-3 minutes in that first half, and they were in that game with a top 10 team in the country. So I think you just continue to give confidence to Deshaun Harris-Smith. Although he didn't score the ball, I thought he had a phenomenal game. I thought he gave energy. I thought he defended well. I thought he shared, like, moved the ball as a ball mover. I mean, Geronimo came in and got that steal, got out of transition. He got that block at the rim on Colin Carr. So you just need those guys to give you production in other ways, because the starters, I know they're heavily leaned on. I mean, that starting group is good enough. But I think Jacoby Gillespie, I don't see him going 2-for-10 from the field again. He had been playing so well coming into that game. He was kind of due for one. But I think Maryland still – I still think they're the most talented team in the league. And if I had to take a team for the tournament, I'm still taking Michigan State and Maryland to make the deepest runs.
Talking to Rafael Davis from the Big Ten, what did you think about the last Maryland possession? Just critique the Gillespie decision to take the three with 4.5 to go.
Growing up, guys aren't in their driveway practicing game winners on layups. Like, guys aren't going 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
By the way, nobody's ever done that. You know, even going back 30 years, you're taking a deep shot.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, I know everybody can play couch coach and play, you can look at it in hindsight and say he shouldn't have shot the jumper, but that's the game. Like, that's what we do. Tie game, you shoot the jumper, you run around, you win the game. But only critique I would have of it. And also, you look at it, Jacoby Gillespie's been playing at a first-team all-conference level. He's shooting over 40% from deep. He has that type of confidence to make that type of shot because he's made those shots before. But only critique I may have would be that he shot it 1 second early. But, like, I'm sitting there with Coach Weber, and Coach Weber's coaching the national championship, been to Final Four and whatnot. And he says, when he tells his guys in that situation, you want to shoot it around 3.5 seconds to four. So maybe Gillespie shot it a second early, maybe, because you want to shoot it with enough time to have your chance to give an offensive rebound or a putback. So maybe he shot it a second early, 1.5 seconds early. But outside of that, I mean, the shot was fine to me. I mean, you miss it, you go into overtime. But you look at how Maryland, when they've had success this season, they've dominated offensive rebounder category. So he shoots that shot, thinking his guys may have a chance to get that rebound and give him enough time to get a putback. But it's just Jackson, he took a weird bounce. Jackson Kohler got that basketball right to Trey Holloman right when he needed to, and he knocked down that shot. But maybe he shot it too soon, but I have no issues with the shot at all.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it was the most open look he had all night, pretty much. You know, sure, you would have liked it a second later, but you lost on a 62-foot shot. You know, what are you going to do? We're talking to Rafael Davis. So Maryland's chances to win the Big Ten regular season title are now over. I mean, there was still some hope for us had we won last night, run the table, because they get Michigan next week, that they could have at least worked their way into a share of it. But you like Michigan State and Maryland in terms of the two Big Ten teams that have a chance to make the deepest run. How deep?
I think Maryland get to a Final Four. Like, honestly, I think Maryland has enough. Like, you go back, like, everybody's going to talk about their depth. Everyone's going to talk about their bench. But I challenge you to go to 2015 and look at Wisconsin. Look at 2015, Wisconsin played a national championship. It was Sam Decker. It was Frank Kaminsky. It was Nigel Hayes. And then you had a guy, you had Josh Gasser as a defender in a start lineup. Bronson Koenig would make shots here and there down the stretch in big games. But off their bench, they didn't have anything off their bench. I mean, they went – they're starters. They went Frank the Tank. And what if Frank would have got hurt? You don't have a run. So my thing is, I don't buy into that, oh, what if a guy gets injured? What if a guy gets in foul trouble? Because you just need four horses. And Maryland has five. Like, Maryland, like, if I take out – you take out Selt Miguel, you put him as a sixth man, and you start Deshaun Harris-Smith, Maryland still has the best starting five in the conference. So I just think that – I think they have enough to make a deep run. They maybe have one of the better front courts in the country. They have an NBA player, a lottery pick in Derrick Queen. They have one of the better backcourts in the college basketball with Rice, Jacoby, and Selton. All three of the guards can make shots from deep. I mean, they got playmakers. All three guards defend at a high level. And they're not scared. Like, those dudes are tough. So I think if Maryland get at their best basketball, their team, I think, can reach the Final Four, reach an Elite Eight, and really make some noise because they're just that talented. And Jacoby's that good. And Rodney Rice, man, Rodney Rice is a player. Rodney Rice is going to turn himself into an NBA guy. And then Michigan State, the same. I think they're the way Michigan State, the way they play you, how physical they are, how fast they are, the technique they play with and the strategies, I think they're a team that can make a deep run. But I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if Michigan got there. Michigan's talented. Michigan hits you with those 2 7-footers, and they're really good. So I think Maryland has the most talent in the league. If you line it up, you give me 5. I think, obviously, Michigan State, they have the depth, the athleticism, and the ability to get up and down. But I think Michigan in the half court, March Madness sometimes comes to half court basketball, and I think Michigan could be dangerous as well.
Yeah, I said the other day about Rodney Rice, I said, I think I'm watching a first-round pick in 2026 develop before very eyes, because he was not supposed to be this when they got him out of the portal from Virginia Tech. No one was expecting this, but you think he's a pro too?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, Rodney Rice is 6'4". He can guard 1, 2, 3. I mean, he can shoot the basketball. He's like 37-38% from deep. He's a five-level scorer. I mean, guys, how about three-level scorers? Being able to shoot a three, make a mid-range, get to the basket. But Rodney Rice is really good in ball screen, and Rodney Rice is really good in ISO situations. Like, he can go get his own bucket. So Rodney Rice, he's talented, man. He's like, just think if your best defender could also go get you 20. I mean, he is really, really good. And there's nights where you can't put your best defender on him because your best defender may be guarding Jacoby, and Rodney Rice just kills you. I think he's the X factor to their attack. I think he gives them a lot on both ends. I don't see a way. I know Jacoby's going to make an All-Big Ten team. Derrick Queen should be first team. I could see Julian Reese sneaking in there, second team as well. But I think it'll be a complete disservice to overlook Rodney Rice on the All-Big Ten team. He is that good. He's having that good of a season. He's one of my favorite players to watch on both ends of the floor. He just goes after, he plays hard. You could see it early on this season when he was coming off the bench. I mean, he forced Kevin Willard to start him as a starter, and he's been balling. Last 5, 6 games, I think he's averaging close to 20 points on over 50% from the field. I mean, Rodney Rice, he's been big time.
Yeah, for sure. Who's going to win Freshman of the Year?
Derrick Queen, no question. I guess not even close. I don't think that's a conversation anymore. I think what Derrick Queen has put in this season, in the position he's put Maryland in the Big Ten, in the NCAA race, getting a high seed in the tournament, and him actually being the guy and living up to those expectations in the year where he was undervalued as far as freshmen in this conference. You look at Ace Bailey, you look at Dylan Harper, you look at Kasper Jakusconis. I think Derrick Queen, and he's done it not just scoring the ball, but he's done it rebounding the ball. And then his defense, that's the thing that separates him as well among the freshmen. Derrick Queen can guard. Derrick Queen can guard your 5-man, but also Derrick Queen can switch and keep the point guard in front of him. And if he gets beat, he has enough length to go contest shots at the basket. I think it's Derrick Queen's award it's Derrick Queen's award. And I think he's put himself in that position, and he's put Maryland in that position to be where they are right now. And there's got to be some value into that. You look at Dylan Harper, Ace Bailey, they're putting up big-time numbers, but they're losing games. And Dylan Harper had that stretch where he had to sit out from illness and injuries, and I get that. Ace Bailey's been up and down this season. He's here, he's there. And then Kasper Jakusconis, over the last 5, 6 games, he's just really struggled. He's just not been the same as who he was in the non-conference. So I think this is Derrick Queen's award, and he's done it. He's done it against the best teams in the conference too. So I've been high on Derrick Queen. Like, I thought Derrick Queen was Mont Verde's best player, and he played with Cooper Flagg in high school.
Yeah.
So he was with Cooper Flagg. He was with Asa Newell. He was with Liam McNeely. And I thought he was their best player. And Coach Willard said it a couple weeks ago. If Derrick Queen was an overseas guy, if he was from Europe, he'd be a top 5 pick with that skill set. And I believe that as well. That made some sense to me. I know people were on Coach for that, but that made some sense to me. Because you look at how guys are talking about Tomislavi Vintage coming into this season being a lottery pick. Derrick Queen's better than Tomislav.
Raphael, he actually said he'd be the number 1 pick, not a top 5 pick, but he'd be the number 1 pick. It's funny because I think everybody that's watched Derrick said, yeah, that makes sense. But at the same time, I think he can stretch the floor and will eventually, but he doesn't shoot the 3. He's not a stretch 4 at this point, which is what you sort of equate more to the Euro-style player. I mean, the old school, you know, moves that he has and the vision and the handle and the hands and the whole thing, but he does not stretch the floor yet. I think he can. Do you?
Yeah, he'll stretch the floor. Like I said, I just had the luxury – to watch him since he's been in high school. So I know he can shoot the basketball. It's just going to be a matter of just like Zach Edey. No one thought Zach Edey could shoot the basketball, but now he's knocking out threes all over in the NBA. So you look at a guy like a Tomislavi Vistage, it's not like he's out here shooting 40% from deep. He's in the low 30s. I just think with Derrick Queen's ability, the way he offsets the not being able to shoot that basketball that well from deep, is he can put the ball on the ground and go make a play off the dribble. You look at, and I'm only using Tomislav, and nothing against Tomislav, really good player. He's just one that comes to mind. He's not out there making moves off the dribble, crossing over, hitting somebody on the move. Like, it's so hard to get somebody Derrick Queen's size to be able to go full speed, make a move against defense, and then make a pass. Like, Derrick Queen he's special in that regard. So I get what you're saying about stretching it to three, but he's a guy, too, where you're going to have to close out to him regardless, because if you don't, he's going to attack you on a dribble. And you don't want a Derrick Queen going full steam at you. That's how he's been cooking teams this year. You close out short, he's still going to take that one long dribble and then that hesitation dribble, and then he's right at the basket.
Yeah, Rafael, by the way, referring to Illinois center, who did not play against Maryland when Maryland went to Champaign and blew the Fighting Illini out. All right, one more for you. We're 2 weeks away this Sunday from Selection Sunday. Two-part. Give me your national championship winner right now, and give me a team that you view as a significant sleeper, maybe an outside the top four, top 16, top four in a region, top 16 in the country.
Oh, man. My national champion, I go Michigan State, actually. That sounds, I can see Michigan State winning the national championship. You look at Auburn as the best team in the country, right? And Jahni Broome has been outstanding. Jahni Broome has been a man among boys. But if there's one team that I know that could throw guys at Jahni Broome, it'd be Michigan State. You look at Michigan State last night and what they were able to throw at Derrick Queen and Julian Reach, those four bigs between Carson Cooper, Zapala, Xavier Booker, Jackson Kohler, those 4 7-foot bigs that you throw out there. And I think they could really bother a guy like Jahni Broome. They could really affect his production in the ball game. You saw what they did to Derrick Queen. I mean, Derrick Queen struggled last night. We talked about it. Him and Julian Reese go 4 for 18 from the field. So if you get Jahni Broome to struggle, you can get Maryland. And then you also look at the guard play that Michigan State has defensively. I think they can check Maryland. And then the athleticism, they have enough to get up and down with a team like Duke. They have enough guys to be able to throw at Duke and make things uncomfortable for them. So I put Michigan State in that conversation. Obviously, Auburn and Duke, they're right there. But I don't think Michigan State's far behind. I know that everybody's going to say they don't shoot the ball well from deep. I don't. When you rebound the way they do, when you score in transition,
just
when
get
you
it get up to on the rim.
Line, exactly. And then I think the sleeper team, I know you said outside of the top 16, but I still think Maryland's my sleeper team to get there. I think Maryland can really get there. They could win it. They have enough talent. And I think Coach Willard's a good enough coach.
At Rafael Davis, Rapheal Davis 3, the number 3 on X on Twitter. Thank you for doing this. Love catching up with you. You're doing a great job. Talk soon.
I appreciate you, Kevin. You have a good one.
Rafael Davis, everybody. When we come back, the NFL's considering tweaking the overtime rule. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
Jaden Daniels, end zone, it is! Caught for the touchdown! Zagertz takes Washington into the playoffs!
That came at the end of a 12-play drive to start overtime on Sunday Night Football, December 29th, against the Atlanta Falcons. Washington beat the Falcons 30-24, clinched a playoff berth. Atlanta never saw the ball in overtime. That may change starting next year. By the way, Ted Leonsis was with me on my podcast yesterday. I'm going to play a chunk of that with him talking about how he's handling the process of the Wizards, you know, going through these years of accumulating draft choices, and they're not going to be very good for a while. How he's handling that, you'll hear that at 12 noon. Ryan Fowler, who covers the NFL draft, will join us at 12:25. So, I think most of you know, the overtime rule in the NFL's regular season is different than the NFL's overtime rule in the postseason. Here's some data I did not realize. Troy Vincent, the league executive and the head of the rules committee, said, quote, "It's time to rethink the overtime rule," closed quote, at the NFL Indy Combine yesterday. He said the competition committee agrees that overtime rules will be addressed. Receiving the ball first, okay, winning the coin toss in the regular season and taking the ball has become more of an advantage than pre-2011 when overtime was sudden death. The rule right now, and it got changed in 2012 when you could score a touchdown on the opening drive and the other team would not get a chance to touch the ball. But if you kicked a field goal, the other team would still have a chance to get the football. That's been the overtime rule in the regular season for a while. In the playoffs, you're guaranteed a possession even if the team who receives the opening kickoff goes down and scores a touchdown. But listen to some of this data. Receiving teams, okay, by the way, that's more often than not teams that won the coin toss, won 56.8% of the games in overtime from 2017 to 2024, up from 55.4% from 2001 to 2011. Now, how many of those teams won on the first possession? Less than 50%. You know, if you go back to 2001 to 2011, the overtime rule, the old overtime rule, that data, 55.4%, the receiving team in overtime won the game 55.4%, but they only won the game on the opening possession of overtime 50.4% of the time. You know, remember with the old overtime rule, there was that feeling, well, if you lose the coin toss, you lose the game because you're never going to see the ball because all they got to do is get into field goal range. Well, actually, 50% of the time, basically, the other team had a chance to get the football. But still, the team that won the coin toss ended up winning or received to open up overtime, won the majority of the games. And now that number's gone up. That number has gone up. I wonder why that is. Like, I was thinking about that. I guess in part because you're trying to score that touchdown on the opening drive to end the game. Maybe you drive it further on average. Maybe teams that take over on a possession after you punt it or kick a field goal on your opening drive, then either match it with a field goal or are unable to match it with a field goal. I mean, bottom line is they're looking to change the overtime rules. The change is going to be, if they do it and it's got to be voted on, they're going to change it to the overtime rule, which, by the way, must come, and I didn't read this in the story about this, but I would assume it must have attached to it the increase back to a 15-minute overtime from 10 minutes. Because remember, they reduced overtime for safety reasons from 15 minutes to 10 minutes. Well, if you're going to allow a team to score a touchdown and the game not to end, you can't have a 10-minute overtime. A team could go on a 7-8-minute drive, score a touchdown, and now the other team's got 2 minutes, 3 minutes to go down and tie the game? No. You're going to have to give, if the idea is to make it competitively fair so that the team that doesn't receive and doesn't start with the football first have an advantage, you've got to extend the overtime to 15 minutes. So look for that to potentially be a new rule in 2025. Overtime going to 15 minutes and overtime going to the playoff rule, which was adopted in 2022 or shortly after 2022 when the Bills lost that epic 42-36 game to the Chiefs when they never touched the ball in overtime. That was the last overtime game we got without the new rule, which is, yeah, you can go down and score a touchdown, but we're going to get the ball. And that's why when Kyle Shanahan took the ball in overtime against Kansas City, it was a mistake. Because then when Kansas City got the ball back, they knew exactly what they needed. You know, in that case, it was a field goal to tie, a touchdown to win. So what we'll see with the overtime rule. If it does get changed, and it sounds like it will, you'll see now teams that win the toss defer and give the other team the ball first. It'll be more like the college rule without the, you know, down and distance situation, the 25-yard line. But you'll want, when you get the ball for your offensive possession, you'll want to know what you need. Do we need a touchdown? Do we need a field goal? What do we need to win the game? Or can we consider punting? You know, the advantage of having the ball second with the overtime rules is you're now, if you're losing the game, even if it's by 7 or 3, you are now a 4-down team. You have that 4-down opportunity. You're not going to punt the football. You can't punt the football if you're losing in overtime. So anyway, look for that. By the way, there's another rule change that is headed our way. Mark Maskey in the Post writes extensively about this. The NFL intends to use its electronic system to measure first downs in the 2025 regular season. The implementation of this technology does not require an approval vote by NFL team owners. So we are going to see this. This has been announced. The league is going to deploy this electronic system to measure first downs. Now, let me kind of net it out for you. This is not going to take chains off the field, first down markers off the field. They are still going to be used as a backup. This is not going to be used to spot the football. God, how many times as NFL fans, when we're watching games, do we watch the spot of the football and say, what are you doing, dude? You missed it by like a half yard. And now it's third and a half yard instead of a first down. It's not going to be used for spotting the football. The referees will still continue to spot the football. What it will be used for is to quickly identify whether or not the spot of the football is a first down or not. So they'll be communicated to via the technology, hey, that's a first down. We don't need to measure. We don't need to take a hard look at it. Or, you know, a lot of times you'll see referees, you know, looking at it. Do we need to measure, not measure? They'll be told whether or not their spot is a first down. And then with respect to the spot itself, well, that's what the challenge system is for. And we do get occasionally from New York, we'll get, if it's a truly awful spot, the referees, without a play being challenged, will be told, actually, you missed it by a yard. You know, back it up a yard. It's actually third and one. It's not a first down. So we're going to get that. We're going to get the electronic system to measure first downs in 2025, and we're going to get a vote on changing the overtime rules for 2025. You know, I'm, by the way, it has not been said by Troy Vincent that the overtime rules will mirror what they have in the postseason. I'm just assuming that it will. To me, that makes the most sense. I mean, what else could you change about the overtime if you want it to be more competitively fair for the team that doesn't receive the football to start overtime? I mean, the only thing you can go to from where you are now is to ensure that that team has a possession if the other team scores. They do get that possession if the other team kicks a field goal. They don't currently if the other team scores a touchdown. I think that'll change, and I think they'll move overtime to 15 minutes. So this, by the way, you know, after earlier in the week, Troy Vincent said tush-push is going to be looked at. I have a weird feeling that that's going to be dealt with. I know a lot of people, that may be a contrarian view. I just think that people around the league feel the way Mark Murphy does, that it's just not a football play. And I pointed out the other day that there's a lot of focus on the tush push on fourth and one, or even third and one. It's really in the fact that it's, you know, a scrum, it's a rugby scrum, it doesn't really feel like an NFL play. There is, by the way, increased injury risk, etc. But what really should be discussed by those that want the tush push abolished is that it's not just, you know, a fourth and one or a third and one. Sometimes it's a third and 2.5 play. You know, so you get back-to-back tush pushes. Who wants to see that anymore? I don't, and it has nothing to do with this being a play that the team in our division, the Philadelphia Eagles, have made famous. If this were a play Jacksonville's been using for the last 2 years, 3 years, I'd still feel the same way. I understand that not everybody agrees. Some of you are like, well, you know, stop it. Well, stop it, okay, except for the fact that they were on the verge of awarding Philadelphia a touchdown because of Washington trying to stop it, trying to time it up by having Frankie Louvu jump over the line of scrimmage and nail Jalen Hurts by timing it. He just mistimed it a couple of times. I mean, how else are you going to stop it consistently? Defenses are going to have to come up with ways. You can't, after multiple offsides in a row, you can't award a touchdown. They can by rule now. I think that's going to be dealt with. I do. I may be way off on that. They've got it. Guys like Mark Murphy, who are arguing against this, need to discuss it in the terms of not just one play, but sometimes two plays to move the sticks, two tush pushes, two brotherly shoves in a row. I don't want to see third and three, third and two, tush push, tush push. I don't want to see that anymore. I want to see real football. And then lastly, Troy Vincent confirmed yesterday. I'm looking for the quote now. Yeah, here it is. On the new kickoff rule. He said, quote, "I think it'll land on the 35-yard line being that touchback area," closed quote. So the new kickoff rule from this past season was a one-year rule. It has to be approved for 2025. Several people in the league, several of the key decision makers, competition committee, etc., want to penalize teams that kick it into the end zone attempting to force a touchback by 5 more yards. So instead of the ball coming out to the 30-yard line on a touchback, it would come back out to the 35-yard line. They think that could increase even further the number of kickoffs that get returned. That requires 24 of 32 owners. That requires 3/4 of a vote. I personally think that we saw enough of an increase in kickoff returns. I think penalizing a team by giving the other team the ball at the 35-yard line is just too big of a penalty. It's a massive advantage to start your drive at the 35-yard line following a kickoff. I mean, you are literally, in most cases, 2 first downs away from field goal range. And I'm not saying, like I said the other day, not 20 yards exactly. Most first downs aren't 10 and 10. You know, most of them are on average about 12 to 13 yards and then 12 to 13 yards of yardage that end up moving the chains. So, you know, 26 yards of field position gets you to the other team's 41-yard line. That's field goal range in this league. I don't want 2 first downs to equal 3 points. I think you got to earn it a little bit more. I didn't have a problem with the kickoff rule. I thought I was going to hate the look and feel of it. Got used to it, like everything, right? But it was fine, okay? It increased the number of kickoff returns we saw. It increased, you know, starting field position for the offense. It did, you know, force teams to strategize over the play. It became less of a non-play than it was before. I think they hit the sweet spot. I think it was 32.8% of the kicks were touchbacks. I think that was the number, you know, so it was down from the previous year. I just don't hear a lot of clamoring from NFL fans about, you know, messing anymore with the kickoff rule, but it looks like they're going to. It looks like they're going to make touchbacks an even bigger penalty to the kicking team, giving the offense the ball at the 35. Look, it probably will, you know, I think encourage more kickoffs into the landing zone, you know, in between the goal line and the 20. All right, so some NFL news with respect to rules coming out of the combine. We'll talk with Ryan Fowler about some of the players at the combine and something he reported yesterday about Washington and a running back in the combine. When we come back, a little bit more on Washington's current approach here in the offseason. Ted Leonsis at 12, Ryan Fowler at 12:25. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app. This email from Cole. Cole writes, Kevin, why didn't you spend more time on what a nightmare Martin Mayhew was as the team's general manager? The last blow, Emmanuel Forbes instead of Christian Gonzalez, that pick alone cost the team the picks they gave up for Lattimore. They would have never had to make that trade. A top three all-time Snyder mishap behind the Zorn hiring and not signing Kirk Cousins to a long-term deal. I know Mayhew is a Super Bowl champion here and a really good guy, not good at his job. Thank you, Cole. Look, no one had a chance to succeed in this organization when Dan Snyder owned the team. We're going to have to just look back at the Riveras. And look, Zorn wasn't going to succeed anyway. You know, anyway, anywhere. So I understand that one. Although that's not number one. Forbes over Christian Gonzalez, a top three all-time Snyder flub? Seriously? I mean, what are we counting? Are we counting the sexual harassment, the treatment of employees? I mean, if we stick to football, the number one by far and away was Marty Schottenheimer. That was his opportunity to have an organization that won and won with a level of competence. The Snyder era, the number one mistake in the moment. I mean, we can look back on various, you know, mistakes that were made that we didn't think were mistakes in the moment. You know, drafting RG3. You know, there are a bunch of those. I mean, hell, when Albert Haynesworth was signed, Albert Haynesworth was a dominant player. They had not signed an interior offensive lineman or a D lineman in free agency. But in the moment and in hindsight, the number one football flub by Snyder, mishap by Snyder, was running Marty Schottenheimer after 1 year. Easily. I don't think there's a close second. Marty had this thing on the verge of going on a big run because that's what he did everywhere he went. And when he left here, he did that in San Diego with the Chargers. Washington would have been in the postseason a lot. They would have won divisions. They would have won 11 games or more a lot earlier than 2024. So, yeah, that's number one. Yeah, I mean, look, I can't kick Martin Mayhew on the way out the door. First of all, he was probably in the right role that he was just in as sort of a support system to a guy like Adam Peters. And again, no one had a chance to succeed at a high level with Dan Snyder owning the team. Nobody. Joe Gibbs. We had Joe on the show a couple of weeks ago. I love Joe. Joe didn't have a winning record as the head coach with Snyder. He got to the playoffs twice in 4 years. So I think when we, you know, as we grow older and we remember the nightmare of Snyder, those that were there, they just caught a lot of shrapnel. It was the reverse car wash. Come in clean, leave dirty, but I think we understood why. Ron Rivera falls into that category to a certain degree. Ron Rivera was beloved by his players at Carolina. Giving him dual duties was a big mistake. But even if he had had one duty, he wouldn't have succeeded. All right, Ted Leonsis next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and theteam980.com.